Hello, welcome to the Second Society Project. My name is David Schmidt, and my guest today is Patrick Wood. Many of you know of Mr. Wood's work from his online presence in Technocracy Today, as well as books such as Technocracy Rising and Trilaterals Over Washington. Welcome,
Mr. Wood. Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Good to be with you today.
Yes, it's good. I'm glad we have this chance to chat. So we're both sort of in this mission, if you will, that overlaps in large part. I don't know where it doesn't overlap, but just to be careful in my claim there. Of bringing a skeptical light to a world that is rushing headlong into a state of, how would we say it, technological slavery. And you've thought long and hard about this. If I understand it correctly, you and Dr. Anthony Sutton started this quite some decades ago, and now it is it's continuing and it's expanding into an understanding of how technology is being used to bring about not just a monetary control, but really just a worldwide political control.
Well, exactly. And yeah, I've studied and written a lot about it. There was a book, by the way, just talking about the global deception, what's, you know, going on globally right now. There's a book written back in the, I think it was 1970, by an American futurist by the name of Alvin Toffler. His wife co-authored with him. And it was called Future Shock. And
right.
That book, he basically postulated that there would come a time when technology would advance so rapidly and so so far that many people would come to view it as simply magic. In other words, they would not understand what's happening. They would not understand the trends, wouldn't be able to understand how it even got to this place. It's just, you know, he said it's just going to be a scramble. And people will view technology as magic and begin to treat it as that. Well, when you cross into that magical world, anything is possible for you. It's like stepping into Alice in Wonderland's story, where nothing necessarily makes sense whatsoever. And the world today is suffering from this future shock syndrome, where reality cannot be discerned. And, you know, discernment is just gone. And there's all kinds of evidences of that. I know we're going to talk about one of them that you kind of, you know, spent working on. But I'll tell you, back in the early days when I wrote with Anthony Sutton, we focused ourselves on our research, on just really just analyzing the facts and getting after the research itself and writing about it. And we didn't have a lot of diversions. Today, however, we have to do our research. We still a function has to be done. But now, at least I can speak for myself, I'm spending way too much time, maybe half of my time in some days or weeks, debunking things that other people come up with that have no basis in reality whatsoever. It's just like they're in fantasy land. They cook something up. So, oh my gosh, this is happening. And, then we have to spend time, taking it apart, saying, no, that's not the way it is. You know, here's the facts of the matter. Here's the history of the matter. Here's the science of the matter, whatever the case might be, to debunk those false theories. And in some cases, even though they get debunked, people refuse to let go of them anyway. It's a crazy world.
Yes. Well, and I'm glad you, excuse me, I'm glad you brought up Toffler. And, I mean, it is the case that with electronics, essentially any signal can be created. And then when you enter into the realm of semantics or meaning, any level of deception and then counter deception and then ad infinitum is possible. And so it really does present a challenge to all of us, and then especially for a general public that is not used to dealing with, oh, here's that fancy word, epistemology, the question of how do you know what you know. It is difficult for the average person who's simply trying to raise a family and keep a job together. So maybe we can come up with some tools to make that a little bit easier for them. You know, you mentioned something that I was involved with over the weekend. Really, it was started on Friday morning. I dug out my old oscilloscope and some Hall effect detectors, which are magnetic field detectors. Now, these are from my graduate work. I did my doctoral work on orientation and navigation of honeybees in magnetic fields. And so this question of magnets sticking to people, I mean, I had to be dragged into it by a colleague, but I eventually bit, not that I believed it, but that I thought that we could bring some tools to bear on it. I purchased some magnetic card readers that engineers use who work in the field of linear and rotary sensors, but those turned out not to be sensitive enough to pick up anything like any kind of magnetic remnants in biological tissue. But by the afternoon, I had purchased some neodymium magnets at the hardware. And what's significant about that is that they are much stronger than those sort of slate-colored magnets that you stick things to your refrigerator with. And so if anybody has not been following us, there's been the claim that magnets are sticking to the injection sites, people who've been injected for the with the COVID vaccines. And, of course, this led to the suspicion that caught on like wildfire around the globe that people were being injected with all sorts of nanorobots or tracking devices or something iron based, and that this was all part of a nefarious scheme. Now, just so our listeners aren't don't click off the click off the recording. I am also, frankly, extremely dubious about these vaccines, especially the nucleic acid pharmaceuticals, which are really a platform for modifying proteins. So they have wide uses, and the vaccine was just the lost leader to get them introduced to the public. But you and I can discuss that further as this talk goes along. So that's the background. And so I did the natural experiment. I just put the magnets on my two deltoid muscles on the right and left. Those would be the muscles that sort of give shape to the shoulder and upper arm region where you would get the vaccine, typically. And found that the magnet stuck in both locations quite readily. The interesting thing is I probably haven't had a vaccine in about 10 or 12 years. So you see, in that one simple simple experiment. I mean, this is really one of the cores of the scientific method, something called the modus tollens syllogism, right? Is that I was able to rule out it with a sample size of one, really, and with great confidence. Of course, you'd want to do this more, and people are doing it more now. But with that one experiment, we could rule out the possibility that it's a vaccine that is necessary for magnets to stick. Somebody could accurately point out that I have not proven that there aren't nasty things being put into people, and that's quite true. I'm just saying that there is not a necessary vaccine magnet connection there. So I did, and then just to make it real quick, I followed up with putting that magnet on other muscles. I don't know why this hasn't been done, but so I tried it on my on the belly side of my forearm, the underside, what anatomists would call the flexor side, because the muscles on that side flex and curl up the wrist and the fingers. And I found significant magnetic effects over particularly three muscles in the center for those anatomy bugs and muscle building bugs and physicians among us. That would be flexor carpi, radialis, palmaris longus, and flexor carpi ulnaris. I didn't find, interestingly, that the magnet attracted to the other muscles of the arm, nor did I find much attraction, except for one little spot, on the extensor side of the arm. So it's telling us that some muscles attract the magnet, some don't. This becomes a little bit more interesting as we go on. The magnet's also stuck to the that muscle of the shoulder that runs from sort of the back of the neck down to your shoulder and then down your back. It's kind of a triangular or diamond-shaped muscle, that's called trapezius, and then also latissimus dorsi in what the bodybuilders call lats, down lower in your back. That wrap around the torso to the back. And so, two other places where it stuck very well was on the right and left side of the forehead. So you can do this yourself. Please do. You know, stop by the hardware sometime this week. Pick up some neodymium magnets, the really strong ones. A package of three costs me under $7. And you'll see that it works quite well, especially on the forehead. So this gave me a clue. I had taught cadaver anatomy. It gave me a clue that about what these muscles were doing. These are the anti-gravity muscles. These are muscles that maintain posture, or in the case of the forehead muscles, they keep up they raise your eyebrows. They also maintain with constant tone, they maintain the face. And having had Bell's palsy about a dozen years ago, I can tell you when those muscles become paralyzed, as they temporarily did, that side of the face droops, and it's quite painful having that tissue sag down. So they're anti-gravity muscles, and so from that, it follows that these are muscles with many type 1 fibers, and type 1 fibers are those that can maintain a contraction for long periods of time, even hours. They're slow contracting muscles, so these aren't the kind of fibers you need for your finger movements playing the piano. These are muscles that are just going to hold the position for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And now that is the next clue. See how you just go from one inference to the other. And so to maintain those contractions for a long time, you need a lot of a protein called myoglobin. Myoglobin is similar to hemoglobin, which is the oxygen-carrying protein in red blood cells. Myoglobin has a little bit simpler structure. Rather, unlike hemoglobin, it has only one polypeptide globin portion, whereas hemoglobin has four. But myoglobin, like hemoglobin, is an oxygen reservoir, and it has at the center of it a chemical group called a heme, and at the center of the heme is an iron atom. Mm-hmm. And that iron atom, of course, is what is the basis of what I'm going to say are the ferromagnetic properties. One more bit of interesting note about myoglobin is in 1962, the Nobel Prize was shared by Kendrew and Perutz. I forget Kendrew's first name. I think it's Max Perutz. And they did their work on myoglobin, and they used X-ray beams in a technique called X-ray crystallography in order to elucidate the structure of myoglobin. And critical to that method is the fact that myoglobin stacks up in regular arrays, crystals, right? So it's crystallography. So you bounce the X-ray beam off of a crystal, which has this regular periodic structure to it. The X-ray beam, being an electromagnetic wave, has periodicity to it. The frequency of the electromagnetic radiation. So whenever you combine things with regular structures, you get more interesting regular structures, and that's what happens. As that beam bounces off of the myoglobin crystal, there are constructive and destructive combinations of those wave patterns to form a image that can be viewed macroscopically by the researcher, and you know, by measuring those bands, if you will, in the crystallograph, I guess you would call it, then you can make inferences about the spacing of the different parts of the molecule. So now, what's that do for us? To bring this all back to home plate, is that myoglobin can be ordered in space. It has iron at the center, so it can be ordered in space under the influence of a magnetic field. So what I believe is going on is that only when there's a magnet present do those myoglobin molecules in myoglobin-rich muscles in particular order themselves to form essentially something that can attract and be attracted by the magnet. So my guess is that when I explore this further with some electronic devices, I'll find that there's no residual magnetic field, no magnetic remnants in the muscle without the applied or imposed external magnetic field. That's about it. Are there any questions or comments about that so far, Patrick?
Not really, I'll tell you. That's a very good explanation of a long and pretty complicated process. Well, let's just say it's a good technical explanation. One of the things that nobody really asked when this whole thing got started is there any other plausible explanation for the phenomena that people discovered? And it wouldn't have taken long to find out really a pretty simple, you know, what if. I'm reading an article right now that appears on the Iron Disorders Institute webpage about how much iron is in the body. And it's very interesting. It just, the first paragraph starts out, males have an average height of have about 4 grams of iron in their body. Females about 3.5 grams. Children will usually have 3 grams or less. These 3 to 4 grams are distributed throughout the body in hemoglobin, tissues, muscles, bone marrow, blood proteins, enzymes, ferritin, hemosiderin, and transport in plasma. And it goes on with a couple of other paragraphs about how iron is balanced out. You don't want too much of it. You don't want too little of it. It has to be there. It's an essential thing to have in your system. But what happens when you put a needle with an mRNA, messenger RNA gene therapy into somebody's arm, and you put the solution into the arm? Is designed to create a spike protein that is not normal to the human body, at least not at that point. And so what happens? As soon as that injection is made, the body responds, your body responds, or anybody's body would respond. And the most common thing that is reported is redness and swelling. And pain, I might add to it, some pain associated, but almost everybody has redness and swelling. You got to ask the question, okay, when that happens, why are you getting red? Why are you getting pain? Why are you getting swelling? Well, you have hemoglobin in operation right there. And as you said, the other one, I can't pronounce it, I forget it, but, you know, you get the idea. Yeah, those things rush to those areas to put up a defense. And say, at first it says, no, that's not what I want in the body. And they try and, you know, it tries to defend against it. But you have blood proteins in action. You have enzymes. You have, hemoglobin and the other globin that you mentioned in tissues. And, you know, this is as much of a plausible explanation as any for what's happening. And yet, the conspiracy world just goes nuts and comes up with all kinds of wild, fantastical tales about what's going on. And that's not to say some of those things could not be real. But, you know, you see this all over the mainstream media now that, people, wacko nutcakes out there are saying that magnets are sticking to the skin. And then I looked it up on Snopes. Of course, Snopes has something to say. They answer the question, do videos show magnets sticking to people's arms after COVID-19 vaccine? And, of course, they totally say false. It's absolutely fairy tale and it's fakery and, everything else. And it has no basis in fact whatsoever. And so they throw the baby out with the bathwater and just say, nah, they're just a bunch of whacks and, totally false. And, you know, there's the end of the story. So there's this whole battle right now going on, taking up bandwidth in the media world. Is this fake or is this real? And you know, and on one sense, you have to kind of back up and say, who gives a rip anyway? But, you know, they've made it an issue. So you have to answer it. And you've made a good shot at answering it. And it's a perfectly plausible explanation for what's happening. But how many people will listen to you and what you've discovered? Probably about maybe 0.1% of anybody who's involved in it. Anyway, that's just the state of the world today. That's, you know, people are deceived. They have a very hard time getting out of their deception when they're presented with the facts. And they just persist in it. At some point, deception becomes delusion, where you absolutely refuse to give up your individual deceptions and you choose to stay in a state of just being totally deluded.
Well, you know, I think that again, I'm glad that you brought up Toffler's future shock and the thesis that when these changes occur so fast that many people in the general public will find it hard to keep up with. And this is, this is not meant in any kind of chauvinistic way or arrogant way. You know, I mean, it would have been hard. I mean, I have this unusual, you know, background, and it both allows me in a case like this to solve some problems, but also makes me almost unemployable. I mean, how many people have taught cadaver anatomy and studied magnetic effects on honeybees and then has kind of a little bit of this skeptical mind about the political and social event? You know, it's an odd combination. So, I mean, so what we got to do is realize that, you know, the stuff you and I do is a service to the public, and even when it becomes burdensome or outrageously humorous. The you know, since last fall, I've been doing these podcasts. I've done them with this kind of arch skeptic named Joe Atwell, and he has some pretty, you know, what we Christians would find pretty wild theories of history. But, you know, at least he's a skeptic, and it's a pure joy to talk with him in that regard. The but I also did a pod. I was also interviewed by Brian McCall, a law professor who edits this site called Catholic Family News. So we talked about the genetically modifying vaccines. And, you know, so there really is all this important stuff, as you well know, Pat, you've been doing this longer than me. There is really important stuff that people need to be suspicious about. And I liked what you said in Trilaterals over, Washington. About it. I mean, it really, we don't even have to think of it in conspiratorial terms. These people publish all of this stuff.
Yeah,
you know, whether it's Brzezinski's Technotronic Era or these Rockefeller documents or the Agenda 21 documents, and going back to the classic Tragedy and Hope, it's all out there for the reading. And this is really serious stuff. If you want a whodunit, if you have a taste for those kind of fascinating things, there it's all there, and I just want to focus people's attention on what these real problems are, and they're significant, and they're only a mystery in as much as almost all people don't know about them. Mm-hmm. Although they're gaining some ground recently.
Yes, yeah. There's some pretty easy steps that people can take to avoid getting sucked into conspiracy theories. And one of them is, for sure, if you cannot easily find the source of whatever it is you're looking at. In other words, who started, who said it in the first place? If you can't find the original source, you probably just should not grab onto that idea whatsoever. And perhaps, maybe in a day, 2 week, month, the original source might be determined. But if you can't see it pretty easily on day one, you're probably dealing with something that really has no individual source. Secondly, this is a truism of life. All knowledge, all science, which is knowledge, is cumulative in nature, always. In other words, it builds on something that went before. Mm-hmm. You can't invent calculus, for instance, until you've mastered algebra, trigonometry, etc. You just can't. It doesn't come out of the blue. So all truth is based on something that went before. And if that is not obvious to you, if there's absolutely no claim of anything that went before that has a basis in fact, then you're really dealing with somebody's speculation. They just dreamed it up out of the clear blue sky and threw it out into the ether sphere to see, hey, maybe this will stick, and let's see what happens if it does. That's two very easy litmus tests you can use There is something, there's another one that I learned from Anthony Sutton when I was a younger guy. And that was to ask the question about anything you look at, anything you study, anything you, you know, read that somebody else is making a claim, does it pass the smell test? And this is a little bit oblique, you know, it's a little undefined. What does that mean? How do you know, what do you mean the smell test? Well, there is a sense that you can, you know, kind of get a feel for whether something is plausible or whether it's really outrageous. And that's what I, that's what he called and what I call the smell test. If something smells fishy, I immediately back away. It's my knee jerk reaction. I just back away and I wait to see more. If it's, maybe my fishy smell was off base and maybe there will be some forthcoming evidence that will support whatever somebody's saying. And I'm willing to wait for that if it's out there, but I'm not going to go out and perpetuate a myth, or a fairy tale or a fantasy, just because somebody else says it's true. If it doesn't pass the smell test, it won't get my vote.
Right. And, you know, there are, and of course there are conspiracies. There are, and of course, you know, if you or I, were worth, you know, let's say $20 billion a piece. Then probably we more than likely would respond to each other's invitation to go down and have coffee. Mm-hmm. And while we're having coffee, you know, our conversation would probably not be so much about what the Mets are going to do this year, but, you know, rather our conversation might pretty quickly veer into, you know, what sort of giant global economic sectors could we manipulate by in the next 10 years, right? I mean, this is just a natural, I mean, you haven't managed to acquire $20 billion selling peaches on a roadside stand. So you're thinking about things, you go there by thinking about things on a large scale. And so you're just going to continue to do that. This is just natural. This is, you know, they do global manipulations, you know, before breakfast in the morning, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, to somebody whose life is lived at a much simpler level, which is almost all the rest of us, you know, those things can look an awful lot like conspiracies. And really, I mean, conspiracies as a term could be applied to it, you know. But I'm just arguing that that's just... I mean, that's just them doing daily business.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know, the word, the phrase conspiracy theorist has been around for a very long time, and certainly since the early 70s. It was leveled against Sutton and myself repeatedly and constantly by the very people within the Trilateral Commission and their cronies. And it's an oxymoronic statement, conspiracy theory. The dictionary, when I say spurious, I mean really spurious. The dictionary, if you go and look at the word conspiracy to get a definition, it's number one, it's the act of conspiring. It's an evil, unlawful, treacherous, or other plan formulated in secret by two or more persons. That is, they make a plot. Number three, it's a combination of persons for a secret, unlawful, or evil purpose. Four, in the law, it's an agreement by two or more persons to commit a crime, fraud, or other wrongful act. And number five, it's any occurrence in action combining and bringing about a given result. That, you know, all of these subtleties of the word conspiracy as is defined in Webster's and other, you know, dictionaries and encyclopedias, has absolutely nothing to do with quote unquote a conspiracy theory that are supposedly spun up by people wearing tinfoil hats. The definition does not fit, and that's what makes it so damaging. It's really just, it ends up being an ad hominem attack on the people that they intend to smear. But the real conspiracies in life are not lawful. They're evil. They anticipate a crime being committed or a fraud or some other wrongful, illegal act. And that does not apply to people at all like you or me. We're not involved in collusion or sedition or whatever. We have no criminal intent in mind, nor does the amorphous mass of the populist movement that are coming up with a lot of crazy things, nevertheless. But those are not conspiracies, according to the dictionary, according to the law, in any legal sense of the term. The real conspiracies of the world, where unlawful, treacherous plans are being hatched and then put into action, those types of conspiracies more likely fit activities, for instance, of a Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has perpetrated perhaps one of the greatest hoaxes of mankind, at least in this, certainly in this century. And, here is a conspiracy where there were two or more people behind the scenes who conspired to commit a crime. We need to call this what it is. I mean, the real conspiracies have nothing to do with theories. They are facts indeed. And this is, of course, when a lawyer goes to court to prosecute somebody who's committed of a conspiracy like this, a conspiracy to murder or whatever, they go right for the heart of the matter and offer evidence on how those people conspired, where they met, what they said, what they subsequently did to carry out the act, and they'll get prosecuted on that basis. This is where we stand today. Conspiracy is very, very real. But conspiracy theories is really just a term that doesn't fit anything. And yet it does a good job of smearing and canceling and discrediting and marginalizing people who otherwise really have some good things to say about exposing the true conspiracies that are going on.
Yes. So, I mean, there is an ambiguity in some definitions, whether conspiracy is limited to those things that are unlawful, or whether it can include things that are lawful but secretive, let's say. Mm-hmm. There's the other problem of a kind of a pedestrian use of the term conspiracy theory to apply to anything that is a little bit fringe or incorrect. You know, for instance, if I said, I think that we, maybe we shouldn't be putting so much glyphosate on our lawns or something. Mm-hmm. And, and that neighbor might say, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory. I mean, I'm not claiming anybody has conspired. I'm just, the economics of it are that Bayer Monsanto likes to sell glyphosate, That's theorizing, I mean, that's what I do as a scientist or you as an economist. Mm-hmm. I mean, we theorize about things, and you have hypotheses, you have theories, you have laws, there's stages of those definitions, and they're all technical, and they're all perfectly legitimate. So people a lot of times do not understand really. For instance, I hear in certain conversations, regardless of what people believe, I mean, anyone in the audience believes one way or the other about this. Somebody, if they're talking about something like evolution or something, they might use the expression, well, that's just a theory. Well, actually a theory in the world of doing science or other academic, I mean, once something has gotten to be a theory, it has a lot of oomph behind it. So there's that problem with understanding what a theory is. And then the other thing is, there is that, we know it, a CIA document from 1967, I think, which basically was a memo to their operatives, particularly in the media, to advance this notion of conspiracy theory as a way of giving cover or camouflage to the JFK assassination and the official narrative. And that's when you can really map the sudden increase in the use of that term. But theorizing about conspiracies, let's put it into that syntax. Theorizing about conspiracies is precisely what scientists or police detectives or historians or journalists are supposed to be doing every day. You know,
that's right.
So I have some law books up there on my shelf, unfortunately. You know, if you look in there, a lot of that is about conspiracies. we need to have a clear idea about conspiracy. We have to not. I think, you know, you have been interviewed by James Corbett, really a fine public intellectual, you know, who I think he's demonstrated for us the ability to be quite skeptical, even about things that would seem to bolster his worldview. He puts it under the microscope pretty well. At least I've found that to be the case, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. He does.
I think the other thing, Patrick, is you've had a lot of work in a public way through your presence and having contributed to the building of the alternative media. You've had experience with the public's, let's say, struggle to become sophisticated about some difficult things. I mean, one of the things about the magnet is, and I got a little bit of a negative pushback on that. One fellow even wrote me and he said, "No, I have seen the magnet stick to people who are vaccinated." Well, that doesn't undo my findings. And he said, "The experiments must go on." Well, you know, see, the thing is that if you don't have the background to ask questions about myoglobin and magnetic remnants and stuff, you're just going to want the easy thing. It's becoming so burdensome. And I'm not criticizing people for this. They're doing, you know, they have lives to live doing other things other than the goofy stuff I've done. But, you know, so they want to hook on to an easy explanation. This stuff about mRNA and spike proteins and what's an adenovirus, and it's not even clear how what a virus is and how what a cell. Can't you just make it simple? It seems to be the cry that's always going to come from the general public.
Indeed. Well, we struggle on, and we just have to recognize that many people, when they get stuck in their deception, they simply do not want to come out. They don't want to receive any new evidence that might destroy their maybe comfortable status quo. And when a messenger comes along with some other piece of information that they don't like, they will take a shot at the messenger rather than, you know, deal with the facts that are brought to the table.
Hmm. Patrick, I've had you almost an hour of your day. I appreciate it. I would love to have you back sometime to talk about monetary policy and economics. I'm a complete babe in the wood in this regard. Maybe it would be helpful to some new set of listeners to hear maybe you clarify some of that stuff. I mean, silver, gold, paper, fiat. You know, I'd love to hear you talk about that a little bit sometime in the future.
Bet. Yeah, it's a big story for sure. So maybe we could do it sometime.
Okay. Any final thoughts?
Well, not especially. You know, I would just say to people, keep an open mind, but, you know, don't allow the big sewage dump or anything to come into your mind. You need to guard your mind about what you bring into it. And that just means question everything that you hear, question everything that you receive as truth, whether you're reading it, hearing it on TV, or you hear it, read it on the internet somewhere. Be suspicious of everything that you bring into your head, and just do a little check yourself and do a little extra research on the internet to find out if something is true or not, or maybe talk to a friend or somebody else just to get another perspective. And certainly if it smells fishy, just kind of stand back for a while and give it time, and it will either, you know, show itself to be completely untrue, or maybe there will be some facts brought forward. But we need to, generally speaking, all of America needs this right now. They need to bring their protective shield of discernment back up again. They need to fortify it. It's an intentional thing. You get lazy when you drop your discernment shield. We need to bring it back up again and start asking hard questions about everything that comes into our mind. We'd all be better off, I think, today if we did that.
Patrick, I know that you have been organizing essentially cell groups, conversation groups, and encouraging that. How about if you put in a little plug for that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I created in 2018 Citizens for Free Speech. A website is citizensforfreespeech.org, recognizing that that big tech in particular at the time was colluding together. There's a conspiracy theory for you, right? They were colluding together to cancel people off of the internet altogether. So when Facebook dumped somebody, why, the next day it would be Twitter, and then it would be Google, and then it would be whoever. And so I realized at that time that the First Amendment was in serious, serious jeopardy. Of course, that has to do with free speech and our ability to communicate ideas, et cetera. And so I realized that what America is being set up for is for a shutdown in all communication across the country. And I'll tell you what, these people, the enemies of free speech, have done a very good job at scrambling the whole concept of communication. And so we're offering people training classes to learn how to communicate in this twisted environment that we find ourselves in today. How to present your ideas, how to persuade, and how to talk to people without, you know, starting an argument, triggering everybody in sight, to achieve balance to what's going on. In some cases, stuff just needs to be run out of local communities. We very strongly believe that local activism at this point is the only defense that we have to return some sense to our communities. Washington is not going to save us. In many cases, Washington is now weaponized against the people of the country. I just hate to even verbalize that. But we can't expect Washington, D.C. to save us. And I don't care who the president is. We can't really expect our state governments necessarily to come and save us either. It has to happen in our local communities. And so we encourage, we develop, we train. We provide collateral materials and so on to people to be successful in their look and their quest and for getting a seat at the table, if you will, in the local civic arena. And basically putting relationships back together too that have been completely broken by COVID and all the false narratives that have been put out about it. So communication is where it's at. Right now we're communicating, we're on a platform where people don't have to agree with us for sure, but, we're speaking words, and this is what free speech is all about. It's the ability to present an argument, a discussion, a position, a philosophy, whatever, and then let the public domain figure out whether we're full of it or not. And in our case, I don't think they're going to figure that. But nevertheless, this is what free speech is all about. Without free speech, the republic is dead. It's just that simple. We cannot exist without the ability to communicate. And if we are shut down from communicating, if the blog cast and so on are shut down, we will be cooked. And this censorship is, if people don't realize it, has gone way beyond just Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms. You see now WordPress.com canceling people from their website. They just dropped their website account. Boom, gone, because they violated community agreements. Major email platforms like MailChimp, for instance, are dropping people because they violated community standards. Amazon is dropping publishers or authors from their book sale platform because they disagree or they violate community standards or whatever. You have PayPal dropping people. Stripe is dropping people, a big credit card processor, because they violated community standards. And so this censorship thing has gone way, way deep into the fabric of economic activity in America and is extremely dangerous. In every case, it's shutting down communication, vital communication, between people in our country. And this is the spirit of the First Amendment in general. So people should go read it if they're not familiar with it. It is the First Amendment for a reason. I'll put it that way.
Patrick, is kind of an easy way for people to plug into this is to look up Technocracy Today online?
Well, they could look up technocracy.news, but if they want to get involved with the free speech issue, they need to go to citizensforfreespeech.org, and that's all spelled out. It's not the number four. Citizensforfreespeech.org. It doesn't cost anything to join. After all, free speech is free. We are user-supported, however, member-supported, so we appreciate every donation that people give to us to keep on. But people just need to put their name on the line at this point, Dave. You know, even if they can't do anything, even if they don't have any means or platform or money or whatever, every American citizen needs to be on the line with us, at least as a member, to say we stand for free speech.
Right. So, in other words, one of the first things that people can do, and for a lot of people that will be the only thing they can do, but a very important thing they can do, which is developing the right type of skeptical mindset.
Yes.
When we have that, all of a sudden, the whatever you call them, the oligarchs, the cabalists, you name it, they can't overcome that. And just to give people some encouragement, just having these podcasts, I had a university group contact me, and I visited them and gave a talk off campus for sure. So this is how we can really begin to build this infrastructure of citizen awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could put just a little plug in for folks for my podcast, it's a Second Society project, and it can be found at podomatic.com, podomatic.com/podcasts/DE Schmidt. That's SCHMITT, two T's, no D. Podomatic.com/podcast/DE Schmidt. And as Patrick said, please visit citizensforfreespeech.com. And I think with that, we'll say goodbye for now, and I look forward to our next visit.
Sounds good, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.